I have great pleasure today speaking again with Olena, who has been with me before. I met her at the Chino Conference in Chino, California, about a year and a half ago, maybe. And since the Estuary Northwest 2024 conference is coming up in September, I thought it might be fun to revisit some of the people that I have met at conferences in the past. Olena is a software engineer, and she has a very unique mind, and I enjoy talking to her. So I sprang an idea on her. I said, you know, Maps of Meaning is a very interesting book in that the way that it is written, you go through the whole book, and he has set it up so that the introduction to each chapter is kind of a summary of the entire chapter. So when you first start reading it, if you go through the whole book and just read the summaries and then go back and read the book, you have more of a scope of the book to start with. But then after you've read the book, when you get to the very end, the whole book is condensed into the last few pages in a way that when you're reading the sentences on the last few pages, the whole book opens up to you again, like a compression algorithm or something. It's really quite unique the way it works. So I said, why don't we each take a couple of chapters from the end of the book and then just let those chapters open our minds to a set of ideas? So I'm going to let Olena start because she picked a couple of paragraphs on page 467, and we're going to see what she has to say about those paragraphs.
I'll start out just by reading them and then I'll kind of go through my first thoughts and then I'd love to hear what you think about it as well, Karen. So, the first one, the idea of the divine individual took thousands of years to fully develop and is still constantly threatened by direct attack and insidious counter-movement. It is based upon realization that the individual is the locus of experience. All that can be known about reality, we know through experience. It is therefore simplest to assume that all there is of reality is experience, its being and progressive unfolding. Furthermore, it is the subjective aspect of individuality of experience that is divine, not the objective. Man is an animal from the objective viewpoint, worthy of no more consideration than the opinion and opportunities of the moment dictate. From the mythic viewpoint, however, every individual is unique, is a new set of experiences, a new universe, has been granted the ability to bring something new into being, is capable of participating in the act of creation itself. It is the expression of this capacity for creative action that makes the tragic conditions of life tolerable, bearable, remarkable, miraculous. So I think kind of what I wanted to talk about this paragraph stems from a question that you actually asked me when we talked last. You asked me why I got into or why I was interested in Peterson. And I think I gave you like some bad answer. But I think a lot of it had to do with his call to responsibility. I think that I That was like a that was an easy stance for me to take. And from the beginning, Peterson's work resonated a lot with younger men who responded to a call to action that he had set out for them, and he asked them to do. That's, of course, all well and good. Do they must. But it does seem to me that this action-oriented perspective did leave in the shadows a more passive reply to the call of responsibility that at least for me, didn't initially stand out. So the full bearing of personal subjectivity seems to be like a passive acceptance or acquiescence, which is then followed by an affirmative response to what is to come, which would be the dragon that must be fought through an active work of will. And he says that faithful adherence to the reality of personal experience ensures contact with the dragon, and it's during such contact that the great force of the individual spirit makes itself manifest if it's allowed to. But it seems like the submission to subjectivity or individuality comes first, and then it's followed by like an an active encounter with the unknown. What do you think about that?
Well, I'd like to hear more about that. So the acquiescence or the acceptance of individuality is, you think, needs to be prior, needs to be a foundation for preparation to face the dragon.
Yes.
Am I saying that right?
Yes, because he talks a bit about the way that identification with the group and the collective is a sort of stage that must be passed into individuation, and then the potential of the person can be made manifest. So this also does kind of go into like individualism versus collectivism and how those play together, and how much identification can be how much identification with the group can be maintained if you're going to face the Dragon of Chaos.
Okay, well, so let's back up a little bit. I like this idea of playing with the balance between the collective and the individual, because as children are growing up, they definitely need to learn to play well with the group, right? They need to be able to participate with the group in a way that, the way Peterson talks about it, you're outsourcing your sanity. So you observe the reactions of the group to your actions, and then that helps you become more stable and more, to build a foundation on which your individuality can grow. You find, I guess, what you're doing in that is you're poking at the boundaries. Where are my boundaries? How far can I stretch without creating a big problem in the social dynamic? Now, I suppose for every different kind of personality that there's a different limit, because people that are more introverted are going to have us maybe a slightly different boundary shell than people who are very extroverted, and people who are more neurotic, who have more negative emotion. They're not going to adapt well to the grimaces and the eye rolling of the people in the group when they step outside the boundary. And then there will be other people who will just thrive on the grimace and the eye rolling of the people in the rest of the group. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
That makes sense. I think for me, that kind of connects to this concept of intuition, or like just understanding where your personal position, and then the way that that position plays with the world around you, or interacts with the world around you, and that itself ties into like individuality and subjectivity. And subjectivity in a way seems to me like the there's an aspect of it that is very similar to like an active confrontation with an acquiescence or a submission to your subjectivity. Seems similar to me in the active will or actions of the hero, in a way that submission to subjectivity kind of in the background, you do kind of have to keep in mind the terrible mother and, or like your I don't know what the right word is. Submission, or like the realization of, or the acquiescence to subjectivity, kind of, if done well, seems to require that in the background you have this knowledge or understanding of your limitations and the way that the terrible mother could snap back. I should let you respond because I'm not putting my words together well.
Well, I think what I'm hearing you say is that when we begin to acquiesce to our subjectivity, we become aware of our own proclivity to kind of turn into the terrible mother. Peterson's work made me much more aware of that in myself, that I can be, you know, in therapeutic terms, they talk about being the enabler or being the, now I've just lost the word, when you have two people who are, oh, codependent, to be the enabler in the codependent relationship. And that probably arises out of my need to be needed. And so if I can be taking care of everybody and making everybody feel okay, then I feel needed. And but what I'm really doing there is acting out the terrible mother archetype, because I am taking away the agency of the people around me to take care of themselves and to exhibit their own responsibility. But the more that I discover my own interiority, my own subjectivity, and I'm willing to, it's a really interesting word that you're using there, to acquiesce to your own subjectivity. How does that line up with humility?
Because for me, humility, I have this thing where, like, I always feel as though I must hold the image or like the presence of the terrible mother if I am going to be able to count on my actions as being true. So, like, otherwise I feel like I very easily have the ability to fall into a state of tyranny with my within my own position. So, like,
you mean
if
tyrannous with yourself or tyrannous with other people?
Probably both. Probably just the imposition, like you said, the imposition of will, or like the imposition of my agency on somebody else in a need to be needed, like you said, or also just like a internal tyranny where different aspects of myself would be a little bit louder or more tyrannical to and distinguish like life and goodness. I think, yeah, so back to your question on humility. I think humility is a really hard one for me. Because it's one of those things that once you grasp it for a second, it's out of reach again. But like, I guess it's just an ideal that you reach for all the time. And
I was listening to a really good talk yesterday where they're actually discussing the work of Dallas Willard. You familiar with Dallas Willard's work? Oh, wonderful, wonderful thinker, wonderful man, wonderful human being. He passed away a couple of years ago, I think. He wrote a book called The Divine Conspiracy. He wrote a number of books, and he ended up being a pastor sometimes, and he was for many years a professor of philosophy at USC in Los Angeles. He was a student of phenomenology, a student of Husserl, and they were discussing his perspective on the world. And in that discussion, it came up about humility and what does humility look like? And they were talking about the balance between humility and confidence. So whenever you start feeling yourself overly confident, that's a good time to remember humility. But whenever you feel yourself being overly humble, that's a good time to remember confidence. And of course, the confidence comes out of knowing who you are confident in. You're not confident in your own personal power over other people, but confident in God's power to work through you to accomplish his purposes. So it's easy to mistake humility for always sitting back and not participating, or making yourself as small as possible. And there may be times for that. Definitely depend, you know, everything is context dependent, right? If you're with somebody who has a difficulty making themselves present in the moment, then it's very important for the other person to kind of hold back and allow that person to shine a little bit. But we're also given the creative ability to go out and make things happen. And you can't do that if you're always hiding in the corner, I guess. I might be misstating things, but the idea is, if you find yourself just being overly humble, just remember that confidence is an important thing, because you have things to do. Like you were saying, we must do, but at the same time, in the doing, we have to remember this whole business that we're about, that dragons are going to appear, and who are we going to be when the dragon appears? I think that's what you're getting at. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. And that's why I kind of brought up the concept of intuition, because it seems like to be something that's able to confront the dragon in the moment of confrontation, there's a, do you think it's always like an act of will? Because sometimes it must be just an acceptance of, like, a surrender to who you are and what you're capable of, and then that just plays out in the face of the dragon. And this kind of ties into, like, within individuality and subjectivity, there's a requirement of active building of self-reliance for the subjective experience to be trusted as a bearing, which to me sounds like what intuition would be. But is intuition something that's built or succumbed to in the moment? Well, it seems to me that it's built and then succumbed to in the moment.
Yeah, so that's really interesting, thinking about intuition that way, because you can also think of character that way, right? That character doesn't just appear. Mm-hmm. Character is something that comes through experience and through facing challenges along the way and accepting the anomalies that come in and interfere with our lives, and learning patience, and all of these things are part of building character. But in terms of intuition, if I think about when I first started painting, I was just trying to represent, you know, some photograph and make it turn up on a piece of paper with my interference. And then when I began studying creativity and learning about all of the elements and principles of design, and started painting in that direction. So I went through the class 8 times, and every time I went through, I absorbed more and more of how these elements and principles intersect and how they work actively in bringing the painting into being. And in the beginning, I was very conscious of them as I painted. But after I'd gone through this class 8 times, I had done 160 paintings in that kind of series of paintings. And towards the end, I could go into a flow state, and without thinking about it, those elements and principles would just show up in the work, because they had become so integrated into the way that I thought about things that all of my decisions in the moment just reflected those things that were embedded in my subconscious. So I think intuition is kind of that way, that some of it comes from outside ourselves, I think, but then some of it comes through the experiences of life that we've had where we notice things, and those continuing experiences build up and become a part of our subconscious kind of matrix, so that when we come into the new experience, they just come out full force. If maybe that's what being in the flow state is all about. It allows you more access to those things that have become embedded in you, where if you're too conscious of what you're doing, you don't have access to those things that have become embedded.
Do you think that the state of confrontation with the dragon can be done in such a way that it's also a flow state, or is that antithetical to what confrontation with the dragon is?
Wow, that's a good question. That is a really good question.
Yeah, I don't know about that one either.
Well, because I mean, I've had a lot of experience in life with sometimes when I face difficulties that I don't want to face, that I would rather just crawl under the bed and pull the covers over and not face, but it's something I have to face. Sometimes the way I've faced that, I call just, I don't know what kind of car washes you have where you're at, but where I live, the car wash, you drive up onto this like little ramp and it locks your wheels and then it just starts pulling you through the car wash. So once you hook onto the car wash, you're just there for the experience. You're not going to get out of the car. It's just going to happen. So you lock in and then you just let it happen. And I've gone through quite a few difficulties in life that way. I don't think it's the best way to go through, because I don't think there's really any learning that takes place when you just let it happen, like going through the car wash. And I don't know, I wouldn't call that a flow state necessarily. There are other times that I've had to confront a difficult challenge when what I have done consciously is to really try to refresh my relationship with the Lord and spend more time in God's word and let him speak to me in the moment and teach me and give me strength and give me his confidence so that I don't fall apart in the midst of the battle. I don't think I would call that a flow state either. But, you know, having been through a lot of challenges, I can't really differentiate them all out. So.
Yeah. Do you think, you said that you don't think it's the best way to go through that first case that you were describing by kind of just like forcing yourself into it, because you didn't learn, well, it's not a way to actively learn, but do you think that there's like an unconscious learning, I guess, that goes on where you experientially just kind of embody the fact that, okay, we're just going to do something really hard, and then once you get out of it, you're like, oh, we just kind of jumped into the water like this, and it was fine, and so going forward, you know that's how it'll be hopefully in the future.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there is a learning there that you can, in some sense, you can trust the process. And there is a learning there that survival is possible. I mean, I think that's a good learning, right? That survival is possible. You're going to make it through. Like, this is probably a silly example, but childbirth is kind of like that. You can't do anything about it. You can't opt out. You know, I mean, once you're in the process, you're in the process. The baby's going to be there. You know, even when it talks about childbirth in the New Testament, you get that sense of the way it's talking about it, that once the labor pains start, it's going to happen. And you can't really stop the process. It's going to happen. So you've got to go through it. So you can go through it. If you go through it angry and resentful and bitter, it's going to be a lot worse. I think Peterson talks about that a lot, right? That if you let resentment and bitterness take over any experience, it's just going to make it a lot worse. Something more approaching hell than something approaching heaven.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I ask about whether flow state and confrontation with the dragon could be the same, because I feel like sometimes there's not really an out other than just doing that thing, like labor, and whether you're ready for it now, whether you have the proper intuition or character or tools to go through it, you just kind of must, and you have no agency in the situation. And then I'm just thinking through how that affects the character. And
well, I mean, another example I could give, I don't know exactly what you mean by dragon, but when I think about dragon, I think about difficult things, things I'm scared of. I don't like to fly particularly. And every time I get in an airplane, I have to confront the dragon of all these thoughts come at me, you know, what if it goes down? What if it can't get off the ground? And I don't know why that is. When I was 18, 20 years old, and I got on a plane for the first time, it was the most thrilling experience. But then when I started getting older, it just got more and more difficult for me. So I've developed a pattern when I fly that I just start praying. Once we disengage from the gate, I just start praying. And my prayer isn't, oh, let me survive, let me survive. My prayer is, Lord, you're the one who holds this thing up in the air anyway. I mean, aerodynamics was your gig. You're the one who invented it, you know? So I know you're holding this plane. I know you're holding this plane. So I can trust you to hold this plane in the air. I can put my trust in you completely. And that's the prayer that allows me to survive the takeoff and the landing. So it's a sort of a flow state. It's a sort of living in thankfulness, I guess, and recognizing God's presence in the situation, and being able to trust Him to take care of things, because I have no power over it. You know, if something's going to go wacky with that plane, I have no power over that. I have no agency in the situation whatsoever.
Yeah, this also kind of goes into fear, I suppose, because Peterson talks a lot about, especially at the beginning of the book, about how fear is a sort of elemental or emotion or reaction to the world around us and to confrontation with the unknown. So, and the books of wisdom in the Bible also make the claim that the beginning of the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom and knowledge. And Peterson's kind of solution to the problem of fear is the transformation of it into curiosity, and then the engagement and exploration of the benevolent aspect of the unknown, which kind of also talks and equates that to wisdom. I'll just read real quick what he says about that. Redemptive knowledge itself springs from the generative encounter with the unknown, from exploration of aspects of novel things and novel situations. It's part of the potential of things, implicit in them, intrinsic to their nature. This redemptive knowledge is wisdom, knowledge of how to act, generated as a consequence of proper relationship established with the positive aspect of the unknown, the source of all things. So, like, he says that the way we kind of interact with the positive, positive aspect of the mother rather than the negative one is through courage and creative exploration of the unknown. And like you were talking about how there is something that you do in situations where you're afraid, which would be prayer. But then like you also described how there's a sitting, like you simply just must trust God after that. And that trust in God is a little bit more of like a chaotic aspect of the situation, of your ability to deal with the situation. So how much of it do you think is like an act of will, and how much of it is a response to something that is beautiful? And how is that shift from fear to courageous curiosity and exploration made? Like in your situation when you talk about praying on the plane.
Well, it would be easier for me to answer that question if I could shift over to the fear of painting a painting.
Okay.
Because that, for me, that's also a confrontation with the dragon, which is probably why I haven't painted for 4 years. Or since I started this channel, I haven't really, I've done one big painting since then, but that was a commission for somebody. And just on my own, I haven't poked the bear for 4 years because there's a lot of fear involved there. The fear comes up, especially after I've been successful in a painting. Then the next painting, can I do it again? I don't know if I can do it again. And so then this fear takes over. So the positive aspect of the unknown, it's being willing to explore the positive aspect of the unknown that you were talking about. Requires courage and creative exploration. So you asked two questions in there, and
well, we can talk about the second one, I think. Well, okay, let's start with the first one. How much of this is like an act of will, and how much of it is a response to the beauty of the positive feminine, or the positive aspect of the unknown?
Okay, so how much of it is an act of will?
Because that seems to be like the more
thing, goes back to this thing of building the foundation. Okay, so for me, the foundation of the positive aspect of the unknown was built in 1986 when I was a fairly new Christian and had gone to graduate school to prepare to go as a missionary to Japan, and then had gone to Japan. And 3 months after I got there, I got a phone call that my brother had died in a plane crash. And it was my brother who I had had many discussions with about Christ, and he had never been willing to listen at all because he was an atheist. And so all of this stuff came into my mind, like, well, where is he now? And what happens when you die? And, you know, how could this happen? I mean, just all kinds of questions came into my mind. And over the course of the next 6 months, as I grieved and I struggled through this, the final conclusion that I had to come to was that God is good. There is a benevolent aspect of the unknown. He is absolutely good. And whatever decisions he makes regarding us are for our good and for his glory. And ultimately, his glory is our good. So that became the foundation of my life. So whenever anything would crop up, some passage of scripture that would be troubling or some doubt would creep in or somebody would have an argument with me about something, I could always go back to this. Well, God is good. So using that as a lens, how can I understand this thing that happened? So that became the underlying foundation for everything. So when it comes to facing the unknown again, I don't know how much of it is will, because any part of it that is will is already sitting on top of this foundation, this foundational truth that God is good. And so then if I take that whole thing and I move over to making a painting, I can trust the process, because even if the process does not result in the realization of my original vision, what the process does is teach me what I need to know in order to get closer to realizing that vision the next time. But the vision always outruns the skill. So the process really is there to show me what skills I still need to attain. And then the next time around, I still can't reach the vision because it's a new vision. So then I have to learn some more skills. So the whole process is one of showing me what I need to grow in over life. And the fact that the vision always outruns the skill is the gift, because that keeps me growing, keeps me moving upward on a trajectory instead of just being satisfied with where I'm at. So in that way, I think that's part of following after that vision, is like when Peterson talks about that little sparkle of interest that's out in front of you, and how do you get there? You get there by putting your focus on the highest good of which you are capable of conceiving, and then moving towards it. And that is what the process of the painting is. You have this vision of the highest good in your mind. You take the materials of earth, brushes and paints and canvas, and you are attempting to construct a vision of that ultimate good in your mind. And then you see how far short you fall. You can make some sort of a measurement. I fell this far short this time. What do I need to get there? And then you can develop the skills that you need to get there. And next time, the bar has moved up. So you have to keep moving up with the bar. I don't know if that gets at the thing that you're asking, because you're asking about fear, but the fear is that I'm not going to be good enough. But the result is not the. The reason I don't have fear, I shouldn't have fear when I paint, is that the result is not the important thing. The important thing is that I participate in the process and I learn from it.
You said at the beginning that an important part is the laying of the foundation. And this kind of like goes into what my second question is about, how the shift from fear to courageous curiosity and exploration is made. So like, how in that specific experience that you had, how much of it was active will, and how much of it, or I don't know, quantifying it like that is probably doesn't make sense, but how much of it was act of will and how much of it was response, or what was the interplay between that in the laying of the foundation?
Like the difference between initiation and response. Wow, it seems to be the process seems to be some sort of a balance between the two. because it's an initiation and then a response, an initiation and then a response, initiation and then evaluating the what comes from the initiation, evaluating, and then recursively coming back and responding with a new. So what the response is doing is actually taking into account the new context, because every time you initiate something, you've added to the context of what was there before. So now any new move has to take into account this new context. As far as initiation response being coherent with an act of will, and
I was kind of
are you kind of looking at the difference between the masculine and the feminine?
I was equating act of will to the initiation. And do you think initiation comes first? Is that how it must be?
Well, so if I bring it back to the masculine and feminine, I don't think the masculine would initiate without
the presence of the feminine.
In a healthy situation, the masculine doesn't initiate without some sense that there's going to be a positive response. Is that right?
I don't know.
We're just exploring here. I mean, the way my husband talks about it, when we were first dating, we used to talk a lot about how guys thought about the whole dating thing. And he said a lot of the guys that he knew had just given up and they're just happy having pizza and a movie on Friday night because asking is too scary, just way too scary. They're afraid to ask anymore. And so they just stay home. They're afraid to ask because they weren't getting a signal from the other side that it's okay to ask. So I think that the initiation is sort of looking for a signal on the other side.
Yes, but I get that. But this comes into, it seems that the responsibility is on the initiator because Peterson also talks about this, how what an object is in and of itself is subjective to the perceiver. So, and this is, so it's the initiator that kind of forms whether the unknown is going to be benevolent or the terrible mother in a way, or I'm like trying to understand how that dynamic between the initiator and the unknown works.
So you're saying that the initiator has some sort of influence on the responder.
Yes, because that's kind of Peterson's whole thing about personal responsibility, and that's why it got me thinking about his thoughts on subjectivity as well, because he says that it is with the hope and faith and courage that you confront the unknown that creates or like determines what the unknown is, whether it's the terrible aspect of the unknown or the positive one.
Oh, but, oh, oh, okay, 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 okay. Now I see the space you're in. Yes, okay. Yes, I hadn't thought about that in terms of the initiator and the responder. So you fall into chaos. Now you're in chaos and you're surrounded by the unknown. And your attitude, your approach, the quality of your attention determines on what you see when you're in the chaos. And Peterson was talking about this the other day. He was having a great conversation with these two, I think it was with the two young men. It just came out 2 days ago. It was a super good conversation. I can't remember
It's something with coffee hour or something.
podcast. Yeah, the coffee guys. Yeah, iced coffee. It was with the iced coffee guys, and he was saying, when you fall into the chaos, you have, if you see a dragon, that's a good sign for you that there's treasure around, because dragons guard the treasure. So, if you see a dragon, that's a good sign that you should look around for the treasure. And the way that I've phrased that for people over the years is that when you fall into the chaos, when you're in the midst of a difficult, challenging situation, that's where all the treasures are hidden. The treasures are hidden in the darkness. They're not hidden in the light. So the place that you find the treasures are in the midst of the chaos. And therefore, I mean, some people would say, and I don't know that this is true, but some people would say, the sooner you find the treasure, the quicker you can get out of chaos. But I don't think that's really true, because sometimes there are people who stay in the midst of a challenging situation their whole life, and they have no, you can't opt out of it. I mean, like I think of Johnny Erickson, who became a quadriplegic when she was 17, 18 years old from a swimming accident. She's stuck in that chaos for the rest of her life, but she keeps drawing treasures out of that chaos continually, and her life has become a fragrance and a source of treasure for all the people around her. So she's continually finding treasures there that the dragon is hiding.
Yeah. It, I don't know. I don't think I have any more thoughts about that. It just kind of leaves an open question of the, it does seem that the initiation and the state that the initiator is in respect to the chaos and forms what it is, but there also does seem to be a bit of a dynamic because, or a dance, there must be one between the two because the unknown really is very, very big. And so I guess this kind of goes into what I was talking about at the beginning between Peterson's kind of call to individuation, if you want to put it in like Jungian terms, where you, the goal is for the individual to face, to eventually be leave the group in a way that would allow him to find the treasure that is needed to bring back to the group. There's been a lot of, like, I'd say, critique of individualism lately, just because it is often a bit overplayed, and the community and the ability to, like, interact with the other as somebody that you're also a part of and very much linked to is hard within an individualistic framework. But I read, let me just read through like a quote from C.S. Lewis's The Weight of Glory, and then I kind of want to ask you a question about the way that individualism plays into like collectivism, or here he calls it membership. So he says that personality is eternal and inviolable, but then personality is not a datum from which we start. The individualism in which we all begin is only a parody or a shadow of it. True personality lies ahead. How far ahead, most of us, I dare not say. And the key to it does not lie in ourselves. It will not be attained attained by development from within outward. It will come to us when we occupy those spaces in the structure of the eternal cosmos for which we were designed or invented. As a color first reveals its true quality when placed by an excellent artist in its preselected spot between certain others, as a spice reveals its true flavor when inserted just where and when a good cook wishes among the other ingredients, as a dog becomes really doggy only when he has taken his place in the household of man, so we shall first be true persons when we have suffered ourselves to be fitted into our places. So,
what a fantastic quote. I read The Weight of Glory, but I haven't read it for a long time. So I've,
it's a
if I
great
ever
book.
read that quote, I've forgotten it. But that's exactly what we've been trying to nail down here for 5 years, is this fittedness that comes from being in, trying to be in the proper environment so that you're fitted to something that is right instead of something that is all messed up, right?
Yeah, and this is why the reason I read this quote after my thoughts about like Peterson's ideas on individuation is because I don't know how he talks about the fact that the hero must come back to bring the treasure to the group. He doesn't flesh that out very well, I don't think. And that's actually a process of facing the unknown within itself, I think. And so individualism certainly just as a standalone thing doesn't make sense, because you will be impacted by the environment around you. But I just, yeah, what are your thoughts about that? Because I can't even formulate a question.
Well, so I love the way your mind thinks, first of all. I just love the way, and I love the questions that you bring up, and it really makes me think hard, and I don't have any answers necessarily. I'd rather listen to you actually just pose the question. But when you talk about individualism, whether it's, you know, good or bad or a positive or a negative, I think it can obviously be a negative. But on the other side, individualism, in a sense, allowing ourselves to become our own individual selves, because I do believe every person is created to be a unique person. And I also believe that the circumstances of our lives are a gift from God to prepare us for whatever comes next. And that those circumstances, as we experience them, they build our personality and they build our individual personhood. So I've often used the phrase experiential DNA. My physical DNA is unique. My experiential DNA is unique because nobody else has ever had the experiences that I've had. And even if they have had my experiences, they haven't seen them through my eyes. And my eyes are connected to my thoughts and to the framework that I inhabited even when I was first born. You know, there's certain personality frameworks that everybody has when they're born, which makes every single person unique. So in that sense, your individuality is a gift to the world if you allow for the appropriate expression of that individuality into the world. If instead you use your individuality as a power move to control others or to prevent others from expressing their individuality, then your individuality becomes a very bad thing. Because your individuality as a gift to the world means that you have to take into account the community, you have to take into account your family and the community, and that you're expressing your individuality as a way of blessing all of those people.
Yeah. I think that the like I was saying before, the taking on of subjectivity and individuality as Peterson would probably call this like taking up your cross in the Christian language, because there is a if you do that, not even fully, but if you even try to do that, then you come into contact with the unknown. And even like, because I have trouble with this often, especially like relationally, where like I don't express that which I probably should be. And so this kind of the role that I need to be playing in people's lives is like kind of left vacant, and a relinquishing of responsibility that I think I should be taking on. But I don't know.
Well, this is why. So I started painting during a time when I was a new mom when I was 46 years old. So my daughter's 30 now, and I'm 76. And when you're 46, pretty soon you start going through menopause. So when she was a toddler, I was already going through menopause. And for about 50% of women, that does a number on your brain. Your brain just turns to mush. You can't think straight. You can't remember things. Exhaustion takes over. I mean, just a whole lot of things happen. And I was part of that 50%. And it was enough of a struggle to just take care of this toddler. I can remember mornings when it was all that I could do was get my teeth brushed and then just make sure that she stayed safe during the day. And that was my day. But I had a lot of things churning in my mind and in my heart. And so when she was 3 or 4 years old, I started taking art classes just as a way to try to express some of what was going on in me because I couldn't verbalize it. I couldn't articulate it at all. I was way too confused and my brain was just mush. And so I tried to find a way to communicate that. And then I started studying all this creativity stuff. And I realized that every single person, every human being is creative. Your creativity is going to express itself in a unique way based on who you are. Not all people are going to be painters, but some people can cook very creatively. Some people can garden very creatively. Because oftentimes we can't verbalize what we need to verbalize into the world. And yet I do think that every individual is responsible to communicate into the world what they've been given through their life experiences. Because I believe that all these things that have been given into each of us are supposed to be brought back out into the general population for the good of everyone. I kind of think that's the way the Holy Spirit works, is to bring the wholeness into being. And the wholeness comes from everybody participating. But if people aren't speaking, and if they aren't offering their creative, if they're not speaking, then at least they should be offering that creativity back into the world in some way, participating in the wholeness of everything. So if you're having a difficulty, the treasures that you've found, and I understand, I mean, this may not be what you mean, but I think for me, the treasures that I've found in Peterson and Peugeot and a lot of the people that I talk to on my channel, most of the people in my current life are not interested. So I can't bring this into the order that I inhabit without creating some disorder. So I find places where I can talk about it because I think it's important to bring that into the public arena. But then that also means that I have to find a way of distilling these things that I've learned to communicate them in a way that is accessible to the people in my immediate circle. Sometimes I am making it a much smaller claim, but it's a claim that is kind of distilled and, try to find a fragrant way to impart it into the situation that I'm in. And I don't know if that helps at all.
Yeah, it actually does. So you're saying that like there's a creative kind of action or dance that needs to take place to make the explicit implicit and just lived rather than forced upon. Just because, yeah. So it's a smaller pearl that might be appreciated rather than like the I don't want to go with that metaphor because I don't know how to finish it, but
Well, have you ever read The Voyage of the Dawn Treader?
I have not. Who's that
Oh,
by?
it's one of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh, I
I think
probably read that when I was like in elementary
it's
school.
the fourth or fifth book in the Chronicles of Narnia. It's about Eustace Scrub and Jill Poole. And anyway, they end up in Narnia on this pirate ship, which ends up well, maybe it's a ship. I don't know if it's a pirate ship. It ends up on an island, and there's a dragon, and the dragon is hiding treasure. And Eustace is all about wanting that treasure because he hasn't been transformed yet. And there is some sort of arm bracelet or something in the treasure, and he puts it on, and it turns him into the dragon. He becomes the dragon then. So then he's a dragon for a long time until he finally decides he doesn't want to be a dragon anymore. But the point is, there's this whole big treasure house full of gold, which maybe they could have picked up, put on the ship, and brought it back to the community. But that may not have been a healthy thing for the community to have that great big treasure house of gold. It may have been too much for them. And it may have had negative impacts on the way people related to each other. You've seen this sometimes in families that just become immensely wealthy and then they don't know how to handle the wealth and then they're at each other's throats. Or some guy wins the lottery and it creates discord in all of his human relationships because everybody wants a piece of it and they're all at each other's throats about it. So I think there are times when you have to be very discerning about treasure may look a certain way to you when you're in the middle of the chaos, but that may not be useful treasure for the people back home. And there has to be some discernment on what treasure you bring back and how you help integrate it into the order that you were a part of before. And you're right, Peterson doesn't talk about that very much. But you can see him operating it in his life because I've noticed over the last few years, there are certain people he's talking to because they give him an opportunity to tell his story. There's certain people he's talking to because he wants to impart something to them that he's hoping they will get little by little. Richard Dawkins would be a good example. He's trying to bring Richard Dawkins along with this story, even though there's a lot of resistance. He keeps talking to him because he's trying to bring him along. And then there are other people that Peterson talks to just so that the rest of us can hear the interchange and that we can all become more adapted to the world that he sees coming, you know, and you can watch him with the treasure. He has some hard-earned treasure. When he was in that conversation with Iced Coffee, he talked about what he learned through years of unremitting pain. You know, there are some treasures that can be found in that kind of an experience, but then not everybody can handle those treasures too.
It's always that's something that's good to keep in mind, even like the opposite way of the fact that you probably have there are people around you that have treasures that you're not ready for as well. And
Yeah.
so the way that they interact with you probably
Yes.
plays into that.
Yes. That indeed. Indeed. And I think that's one of the big challenges with generations. It's hard for a person of an earlier generation to recognize the treasures that a new generation is bringing into being and to accept those and to be willing to integrate them. Because after all, we've been around for a long time and we know everything, right? But there really are all the treasures that come out of the new generations coming along and discovering, really, they have a fresh take on the chaos that we live in. We get so inured to it because, I mean, I've been around many years, and so I've gotten used to what a mess the world is. And I put up with a lot of things that I probably shouldn't put up with. But when a young person comes into this world and they take a look around and they say, look at all this pain and suffering, we've got to do something, right? That's a kind of a treasure because it's kind of opening your eyes up to something that you have forgotten how to see.
I think this sort of like tension is also created in things like how like environments that somebody might grow up in. Like for example, I grew up in a like a sub like a the immediate, my immediate environment was like very conservative, but like the broader culture and the broad and I grew up in the broader culture was a little bit more liberal, so I think that created a really good sometimes really hard but probably beneficial like tension that helped learn how to like balance the two or hold the that tension of opposites. I do have to go, unfortunately, in 20 minutes. I wish I didn't, because this is a really good conversation. But I wanted to hear what you had to say about the paragraph that you picked.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll just pick one of the paragraphs here and see where we can go with it. My whole point is that this book is just of such a nature that you can pick a paragraph anywhere. And if you have your own framework for understanding the world, you can take that paragraph and explain the whole world from it. So here I am on page 465, and it's the third paragraph on that page. Proclivity to posit an ideal, implicitly or explicitly, to work towards its attainment. To become dissatisfied with its establishment as new matter makes itself manifest, and to thereby re-enter the cycle. This constitutes the centrally defining pattern of human abstraction and behavior. The simplest and most basic day-to-day human activities, invariably goal-directed, are necessarily predicated upon conscious or tradition-bound acceptance of a value hierarchy. Defining the desired future in positive contrast to the insufficient present. To live from the human perspective is to act in light of what is valued, what is desired, what should be, and to maintain sufficient ignorance, in a sense, to allow belief in such value to flourish. I liked that, to maintain sufficient ignorance. To allow belief in such value to flourish.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that.
Yeah. Collapse of faith in the value hierarchy, or more dangerously, collapse of faith in the idea of such hierarchies, brings about severe depression, intrapsychic chaos, and reemergence of existential anxiety. So I thought this was a perfect paragraph to explain. My little maxim that the vision always outruns the skill. But plugged right in the middle there is this idea that to live is to act in light of what is valued, which presupposes that if you don't have a value structure, you can't live, which is a basic of Peterson's ideas. And it's one reason why, although I can see the beauty of the evolutionary theory and I understand its complexity and I see what they call evidence for the evolutionary theory, it makes no sense whatsoever because the first life, if it doesn't have a value structure, can't go anywhere. Because if you don't have a value structure, there's no reason to even move. And the way Peterson describes this is the reason you move forward is better than where you are. So if better doesn't exist, if there's no value hierarchy, then there's no reason to move forward. So then where even could the will to live or the will to survive, where could that come from without this value hierarchy? And he goes on to say, and you also need to maintain sufficient ignorance to allow belief in such value to flourish. So, by sufficient ignorance, I think what he's saying is that you have to be willing to, I can't think of the exact phrase. They use it in theater. When a movie starts or when a play starts and the curtains open on the stage, a willing suspension of disbelief. Okay, you have a willing suspension of disbelief. That's maintaining ignorance in order to accept what you're going to see and to be able to find the story there and to be able to navigate the story. You won't even enter into the story if you don't have this willing suspension of disbelief. So, to me, that's what he's saying there. Collapse, and then he goes on to say, collapse of faith in the value hierarchy, or even faith in the idea of hierarchies, which is what's happened to us. We've lost. And he wrote this back in 99. He started writing it in 85. And it hasn't been until the last, I would say, 20 years where it really has collapsed. The whole idea of hierarchies has collapsed. Brings about depression, intrapsychic chaos, and reemergence of existential anxiety, which we see all around us, right? I mean, that's everywhere. But the first part of the paragraph, he says, proclivity to posit an ideal, implicitly or explicitly, to work towards its attainment. And to become dissatisfied with this establishment as new matter makes itself manifest and to thereby re-enter the cycle. That's the story of making a painting. You're making something, but you're constantly dissatisfied with the result because the result never lives up to your hope, your vision. But that's kind of the way life is. You face the unknown, you have to make choices, you have to make decisions. You try something, it's never quite enough. And so you keep trying. And so to me, this paragraph kind of lays out the whole thing about that the universe is a work of art and that there is a value hierarchy and that there is good and that the unknown is benevolent. Let's put it that way. So
Yeah, that.
that's a kind of a quick run through. If you have any final last words before you go, that would be fun.
I just want to ask you a bit more on the ability to maintain sufficient ignorance. Do you think that maintenance of ignorance must be done in parallel to positing an ideal? When do you think that's what he means by confronting the unknown as the benevolent feminine? Or do you have to keep in mind the terrible mother in this maintenance of ignorance? Or is that even possible? Is maintenance of ignorance just you forget about the terrible mother?
I'm going to have to give that some thought, but the first thought that springs to mind, which I don't think actually gets at your question, but as you were just rereading that, it occurred to me that maintaining sufficient ignorance in that context may have something to do with willing to be humble enough to recognize that I don't know anything and that the benevolent unknown actually has all the answers. I don't know anything. He knows. Therefore, I mean, Peterson would never personalize things that way, but that because the ideal is always a judge. That's one of Peterson's sayings that I think just explains so much of everything. And as I've explored on my channel for a long time, judgment is a kind of measurement. So the ideal is always something against which we are measuring ourselves. And if I'm honest in measuring myself against the ideal, I'm way down here. Here's the ideal is way up here. So the best that I can do is reduce the distance just slightly between me and the ideal. And part of maintaining sufficient ignorance is recognizing the vast distance between myself and the ideal. Now, when you're talking about falling into the chaos, I just got the drift of what you're talking about because I haven't been thinking Petersonese for a while. Chaos is the feminine. So the chaos is both the benevolent feminine and the tyrannical feminine. And so how do you balance out your understanding of that when you're lost in the chaos?
Yeah.
Yeah, it just took me an hour and a half to get there. You're so far
It's
ahead of
okay. No, it's okay.
Yeah, so anyway, that is a big question. Keep thinking about it, and maybe we can get together another time and do this. This has really been fun. Your brain really challenges me, so.
It's really nice to talk to you, Karen. Yeah.
Have a great day at work. Talk to you
Okay, you
later.
too.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Carrie.